guardian.co.uk.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is the American writer Charles Frazier, who talks to John Mullen about his best-selling first novel, Cold Mountain, which won the United States' prestigious National Book Award in 1997. It's the story of a deserter from the Confederate side of the American Civil War. It charts his tortuous journey back home to the mountains of North Carolina and is based on the real experience of one of Frazier's own ancestors. The story is replete with rich details of life in the 1860s, from wildlife to food and farming. So John began by asking him whether this had involved a great deal of research.
Some of it was memory of what the most traditional people when I grew up in the Southern Appalachians, what they cooked and what they ate, and the way they, you know, everything was based on hog and corn. But a lot of it was reading old travel memoirs, and some reporter for the New York Herald or one of those papers was down and got thrown in prison in North Carolina and then escaped, and he wrote about, they were hungry all the time, so he wrote about food a lot until he got back to what he thought was civilization. Somebody a couple of years ago made a list of everything that people ate and then tried to cook it.
Yeah.
But one of them was, it involved a clump of butter the size of a squirrel's head.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he was trying to convert that into teaspoons or cups or something.
One of the extraordinary things about it, which I presume is a sort of seemed completely plausible as a matter of circumstantial sort of detail, is that Ada and Ruby, they live this life of sort of scarcity, but they kind of, and they'll have gluts of certain things, or much more than they can eat at the time. Yeah. So a lot of it seems to be about what you do with that.
Yeah.
Do people bury cabbages, did they?
I did research on how deep the hole would be, how wide the hole would be, how all of that. I mean, most people, a lot of people, had root cellars, and you could keep cabbage for a while, a good while, in a root cellar. But if you needed to keep it till, you know, April, then burying it was a better way.
But I guess all this stuff is quite, I mean, it must have been quite important to you writing, because it's quite important to the novel, isn't it? If a reader started thinking, or maybe that doesn't sound very convincing, started questioning it, would that matter, do you think?
What I thought was, for people now, that world is like science fiction, and I need to create this world that insists on its own reality.
Right.
And so many people over the years have sort of thought, that's the way I live, or that's my daily reality. It's something I learned to construct a book and to make this world that you go into and have some trust in. So it was a lot of work, and then I forget it. So then, you know, I go for a walk with people and they expect me to know every plant and that kind of thing. I knew all that for a very short while.
You do kind of take us through the sort of rhythm of their kind of lives.
Yeah, my grandparents had one of the last of the Southern Appalachian farms that, you know, there wasn't an internal combustion engine on it. There was no indoor plumbing. It was an old-time mountain farm. So I saw that when I was a kid. I saw how that worked. It felt important to record that in some way that got the internals of it, in at least in the way I see the internals of that, of those rhythms, those dependencies on the natural processes, the vulnerability of that, to get all that, as much as I could, into it. It's so hard to imagine people who are tied to the money economy by really slender threads. You know, you needed money for some things, but for 75% of your livelihood, You depended on the ground, the woods, that kind of thing.
The structural principle of having the two stories, was that there from the start?
It was actually the first maybe 6 months I worked on the book. It was going to be this short, really violent, really brutal book that was just Inman killing people, trying to keep from being killed, to come home and be killed. And then I just somehow wrote this little thing about these two women, one who didn't know how to take care of herself in that kind of world, and one who did. It was going to be just like a little bit of a journal of maybe his grandmother or something. It would have been 2 pages in the book. And then I just kept writing it and writing it and writing it. And then I realized the book is not short, nothing but brutal, all that. That it's this two things that are intersecting.
Inman's got his copy of John Bartram, whom I'm afraid I was not au fait with at all until I read your novel.
Bartram was actually an influence on Wordsworth and Coleridge.
Right. Well, I mean, they're kind of extraordinary, sort of slightly ecstatic almost.
Real visionary, William Blake kind of thing, where he's, he's out in the wilderness and just this, like his head's exploding. He did a lot of work in North Florida and then worked his way up into the Carolinas and into western North Carolina, and had contact with the Cherokee early on, and they had a name for him, Flower Gatherer, because that's what he was there to do. Just a remarkable writer and one of those very American kind of stories, I think, for him.
It is beautiful and beautifully observed, but there's also seems something quite bleak about it as well. To me, there was that it's a world in which human beings are scrabbling around too,
and those processes are going on whether we notice them or not, whether we're even here to notice them or not.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried to get that sense in.
He respects bears, and he's got this bit, which is kind of slightly risky bit of narrative, about how he's not going to shoot the bear because he had a dream about being a bear, and so he tries to just evade it. And typically, he knows stuff about how bears. Correct me if I'm wrong. He knows stuff about how bears work because he knows this sort of thing, and he swerves to avoid it. And the bear goes over a precipice. So then he's got this cub, so he has to kill the cub and eat it.
Yeah.
And he has a fantasy about putting it in his rucksack, doesn't he? Yeah. And taking it home and then thinks no.
Well, I mean, bears are part of my daily life. The last one I saw was last week, just down the hill from my house, from my front yard. I guess I've probably never told this. That scene, my wife and I, this was long, long ago, were on a backpacking trip, and we were out on the edge of this cliff, and it was almost dark, and this bear came toward us. And, you know, they don't see that well. Their eyes are not great. They work more by smell. And so I was going to be the hero and say, okay, now I'm going to go around here. I'm going to draw the bear's attention. You go this way as soon as the bear focuses on me. And she was really impressed, and still is, by that. But I just imagined, what if the bear followed me around through this little heathery kind of area, and then sort of lost interest and wandered off. And I just thought, but I was only 30 feet from the edge, and the bear was 30 feet from the edge. What if bears charge, and they do these false charges where they huff and bounce on their front feet and come towards you, but they don't really intend to come get you. They just want to scare you. So what if that bear had done that?
Yeah, do people eat bears still?
Yeah. I mean, it's disgusting. Now, I was talking to some of my relatives that live near Cold Mountain not long ago, and one of them had killed a bear and was passing out meat amongst the the relatives, and I took a pass on on the bear meat.
And this world that Inman wanders through. This is an incredibly predatory, and not even predatory. People just kill each other.
Yeah.
For anything, rather than if they can't think of what to do, they kill you.
One of the things that was important to me was that things not be outside the bounds of what really happened. That I was going to inject my character into these situations that really did happen. There's a scene where there's a massacre, and Inman is shot and buried in a, you know, just dirt barely thrown over him. That really happened. It was a place called Sodom Laurel. These guys had captured some deserters, and they walked them a long way. And then at some point, they decided they had walked far enough, and they just lined them up and shot them. And there were young teenage boys that were shot and killed in that. Really brutal, really, really brutal. The part where the fiddler and the boy that's not quite right in the head... That is, I've been to their graves. That happened. And that little detail was one I didn't have to make up about the fiddle tune. In that part of Western North Carolina, for years and years after the Civil War, that tune that the fiddler played, which was Napoleon's Retreat, if any of you know old-time music, fiddle music, that became known in Western North Carolina as the Groom's Tune, because that was the real name of that the fiddler that was killed.
But most of the violence is people roaming around.
Yeah just not that organized institutional violence. The violence inside individuals that express, you know, a new way of expression in those kinds of times.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a, you know, and that's still in everybody. I don't think human nature changes fundamentally.
But it's in I guess you might want to call him otherwise, the hero of it. I mean, there's quite a disturbing piece early on where he has to fight these guys who sort of threaten him for no apparent, and he hacks at them with a scythe. And then one of them's on the ground, and he's been trying to kill him, but he's on the ground, and he picks up the gun and sort of puts it to his head and tries, but the caps don't work, so he doesn't kill him by chance. He doesn't kill him.
Yeah, no, he's certainly got the instinct. Now, I wanted him to be a warrior and somebody who's really good at this, who gets at moments of violence, is really expert at killing people. He's not really happy to be that way, but he also gets, anger takes over, and he's not thinking about the humanity of that person on the ground. He's thinking, this guy tried to kill me, and I'm going to put him away.
For both the main characters, you contrive a sort of extraordinary a kind of style which reflects, in Inman's case, I don't know, what is it? It's quite a sort of circumlocutory sometimes style of thinking, but it's a style of telling a story.
Yeah. I mean, mainly in regard to that, I remember in terms of the writing of it, there were days where I would hear a voice that was like an old-time mountain voice.
Yeah.
And when I could hear that, you know, that's the kind of thing that voice said. And it was more just a sound. It was this accent. And I knew that was going to be a good day of writing, when that was the way the story was coming to me, was with that kind of voice. And that voice was very bleak in a lot of cases. Well, one of the things that I always thought about with this book is this balance of hope and despair, just that very basic thing about human existence, of how does that balance work in an individual life? How do you keep some kind of balance? And I always think of the narrative voice as being another character in the book. And I'm always annoyed with editors who will talk about, refer to that voice as me.
Yeah.
When I'm writing the book, that's not me. That voice, the voice that's telling the Ada and Ruby parts, is not me. It's a character that knows things about the natural world that I had to reconstruct. And the Inman parts, it's a voice that knows things about violence, about anger, that I had to reconstruct. But when I could hear the voice, then the words felt right. There were, you know, days where that voice was a little bit, stepped back from me, were slow days of writing.
And Ada's voice, not when she's speaking, but when in the third person you're kind of hearing her thoughts, that's a sort of different thing again, isn't it? Because she's this young woman from Carolina, but she kind of reads Adam Bede, there's the George Eliot, you see, and Little Dorrit, and has these kind of odd bits of sort of Ovid or something in her head, little bits of classical mythology.
Yeah.
That seems to affect, again, the sort of the style that you were finding for her thoughts.
Yeah, I did days and days of research on what a well-to-do young woman in Charleston then might have been exposed to, and read diaries and letters and memoirs. And that's always, any of you who want to be writers, that's always an easier, happier day than actually sitting at the computer.
The ending. Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about the ending. It did seem to me that if I'd been a more attentive reader first time round, I would have thought, I know how this is going to end. I don't know exactly how it's going to end, but I think I know how it's roughly going to end.
I tried to convince myself I didn't know how it was going to end. But the story was based on, like, maybe four or five facts that I knew about this ancestor. But the fourth or fifth, whichever one it was that he was killed in a gunfight with the Home Guard. And I knew that from the day I wrote page one of this. And a publisher bought this before it was finished. So I had the last maybe 75 pages to still write. So they, you know, after the deal was done, they called up to say, you know, hi. And then they said, how does it end? And I said, in the real story, he's killed in a gunfight. And there was this, like that. And then three people on this conference call at the same time said, no. And my father, who had told me the story as I was closing in on the ending of the book, said, of course you're going to change the ending, aren't you? And I got to a point where I couldn't write another page without knowing. And I drove all the way across North Carolina to this graveyard where supposedly the ancestor that I based this on is buried, but there's not a marker. And it was sort of one of those pilgrimages that, I don't know, it may have been a little overly dramatic, but I just couldn't come up with an answer. And I stood there at the part of this old cemetery where he supposedly is, and I just thought, well, it would just be stupid to change it, because I knew this from the start. It's got to be built in to this story. So it was from that moment on, I moved right forward with the concluding chapters of the book, and that to do anything else is going to be a patched on happy ending that's not going to be it's not going to be satisfying to me. If it's satisfying to anybody else, I don't know, but
Did they keep the unhappy ending for the film, did they?
I didn't see the film.
Jude Law died, did he?
Oh, I remember an early trip with Anthony Minghella, and he said, Charles, why do people keep asking me if I'm going to change the ending? And I said, well, they keep asking me the same thing. And he said, I've never given it one moment of thought.
Well, we got to the ending, which is a good point for me to end. And to say, anybody here would like to ask Charles a question, the roving mic will come to you.
Thank you. To me, Inman's an incredibly moral character. When he sleeps in the same bed with Sarah, he doesn't touch her. He doesn't kill the boy at the end when he could have done, saved his own life. And when he kills people, he always has a good reason for it. When he kills the three Federals or he kills Junior, it's always sort of killing those who have done evil. Do you see him as a moral character?
You know, he's got a code. It may not be standard morality, but he has a sense of what he thinks is right and wrong. I mean, I was always curious about that, killing those three Federals. You know, was that absolutely necessary for him to do that? That was one where I felt like I might criticize him a little bit for excessive violence.
And Junior, he goes back to kill him, doesn't he?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a climax of revenge or something.
Yeah. I don't know whether he kills him. You don't know whether Junior is still breathing at the end of that beating he takes or not. But that was a relatively gratuitous... I mean, you know, Inman didn't die from Junior's actions, but he came back and either killed him or beat him nearly to death. So there were places where I questioned his love of violence. It might have been a little excessive.
So. I want to ask you, did you tramp the route that Inman took? And I wanted to ask you to clarify about your ancestor. Is he about W.P. Inman, the real W.P. Inman? And whether or not such people could have lived, the goat woman in particular, I thought, you know, could somebody live like that? Is that possible? So that's about four questions.
Okay, now this is going to make me sound like I'm 250 years old. The goat woman was based on the goat man. When I was a little kid, there was a fellow who traveled around the South in a goat cart. And he was sort of a preacher, sort of a, you know, he sold religious pamphlets, but he had a little cart and a bunch of goats. And he traveled around, and he would come to our little town every couple of years, and he'd camp outside of town for a couple of days. And I used to always go out and visit with the goat man. And, you know, you're 10 years old. Gosh, living in a goat cart with a bunch of goats and traveling around, wouldn't that be a great way to live? And so I made up a character that was like that. So that one has a certain edge of reality for me anyway. I did do a lot of research on how the old roads and railways went and what the most likely route would have been. But part of me, there's this wonderful thing that... the name escapes me right now, a Greek geographer after Homer was talking about Odysseus's travels and said, for people who were trying to trace Odysseus's route, he said, you will find something like, you'll find the route of Odysseus when you find the cobbler who sewed up the bag of the four winds. And that's the way I always looked at the geography of this book. There was a map of North Carolina in, you know, 1860. And over the top of that was this other map. And do you all know the Southern Appalachian Jack Tales?
I suspect there might be a few
who don't. It's the same Jack. It's the same Jack that climbs the beanstalk. It's just that he's moved to the Southern Appalachians. And he's always, you know, frequently anyway, out on the road. And Jack's walking down the road, and he's got a heifer hide over him. And he's been thrown out of his home, and he's out on his own. And he's got to find food and shelter and all that. And he's very... crafty and he plays tricks on people and that kind of thing. And he lives, you know, the southern Appalachians, there are kings and dukes and all that, and there are guineas and, people pay for things with guineas. But the kings just live in great big log cabins instead of castles. And it's this very odd southern Appalachian imaginary world. So I always thought of those two kinds of maps overlaying each other. There was a fella in North Carolina a few years ago who did travel what he thought to be Inman's route and wrote a series of newspaper articles about it.
Not the same guy who cooked the meals.
Different one, different one. And he wrote me wanting me to tell him the route. And I said, can't help you on that. It's not a lot of it's not on the map.
I was just interested in your experience of actually writing the book, because the way you were describing it was if you totally become absorbed by the life that you're writing about. And I was trying to imagine what it must be like when you come to the end of the day and you stop writing. How do you then regain the 21st century?
Well, I have a really inconvenient writing schedule. I start work about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and work until I run out of anything to say. So sometimes that's 7 o'clock and sometimes it's much later. Sometime a few years ago, I was home by myself, and my wife and daughter were away and called at about midnight to say goodnight. And it was like, so you still awake? And I said, well, I'm still working. And my daughter said, oh, you college kids.
What sticks in my mind is the weather. The descriptions of the weather and the cold and so on.
Yeah.
And I'd allied to that, how much research did you do on what was likely to be the case at the time?
This is going to be one of those things that makes me seem sort of obsessive compulsive. It was that same reporter I mentioned who was captured and escaped and went. They were trying to get north and wrote a day by day journal at exactly the time that Inman would have been going through that part of North Carolina. And they wrote about the weather every day. So I had a baseline. If I wanted to follow it, here's what the weather really would have been on these dates in that year. And it was horrible weather. It was cold and rainy and snowy. I also had this obsessive compulsive thing about, I had a computer program where you could see the night sky on any date in history. So I had star charts for the entire book. At some point I realized that's too much. Just let that go. So.
How important is visiting the localities that you're writing about, or localities that may be like what you're writing about in your writing? Could you have written the book if you lived in another state, or is it a regional book in a sense?
Part of it for me is I'm a slow writer, and anything that I don't have to make up absolutely from scratch helps. So I would do almost like people making a movie looking for locations. And I would go find a place, either the place that something actually happened or a place like what I was kind of thinking about. So when Stobrod and Pangl are killed, or when Pangl is killed and Stobrod shot, I found a place and I just sat there. It was out in the woods. There was a big hemlock tree, and just sat there with a notebook. And was thinking, okay, so you've got these characters and these two guys and this is happening and here's, you know, I was moving people around and describing the place, the place that I was at with this thing happening at this place with this big tree. And it helps me stay clear on action if I really know the the way the land lays and all that.
Maybe I could sort of, if you forgive me, bring the curtain down by giving the answer which Bob Dylan gave. Can I tell them what? Because Charles was telling us that Bob Dylan's read his book. I think it's pretty good. And he's read the whole of it. We know he's read the whole of it because his comment was that when he got to the end of it, he felt like the guy in the book. Anyway, with Bob Dylan's comment, I'd just like to say thanks very much to Charles. He'll sign some books if anybody wants to bring a book to be signed. And it's great that you could come and talk to us. Thanks very much.
And thank you all.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.